Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. The National Park System, created back in 1916, has a new addition. Earlier this month, Pinnacles National Monument, which is east of Monterey, became the country's 59th national park. Pinnacles was first set aside as a monument in 1908 by President Theodore Roosevelt. Pinnacles National Monument gets its name from rock spires that are remnants of an ancient volcano. The volcano eroded over millions of years as it moved north along the San Andreas Fault. Rock debris in the form of boulders have weathered and settled, leaving behind spires of volcanic rock and caves. Biologists have released condors and Pinnacles as part of a captive breeding program to bring them back from extinction. Pinnacles is also a very popular spot for rock climbers. So what are we learning about how people interact with national parks? We do know that people love them. 92% of Americans believe that funding for national parks should be increased. National parks receive a very tiny fraction of the entire federal budget, 1/14 of 1%. That's 1/14 of 1% of the federal budget. After 2 years of declining funding, national parks now face the prospect of additional cuts of up to 10%. According to the National Parks Conservation Association, that would mean closed visitor centers, closed campgrounds, closed parks, and thousands of park staff out of a job. In 1983, author Wallace Stegner famously said, "National parks are the best idea we've ever had. Absolutely American, absolutely democratic. They reflect us at our best rather than our worst." So on today's Your Call, we are talking about national parks. What is the value of national parks? How are they maintained? And who really speaks for keeping them open and preserved? Today, we're joined by Neil Desai, Pacific Region Associate Director of the National Parks Conservation Association. Their mission is to protect and enhance national parks for present and future generations. Neil leads efforts to protect parks, monuments, and historic sites in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and the Channel Islands. And he joins us here in studio. Hi, Neil. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, good morning.
Great to have you. Brent Plater is Executive Director of the Wild Equity Institute. That's a nonprofit uniting the grassroots conservation and environmental justice movement. He's also a lecturer in San Francisco State's Environmental Studies Department. Previously, Brent served as the Bay Area Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, and Brent also joins us in studio. Hi, Brent. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me in.
Great to have you. So first off, how significant is this, that Pinnacles National Monument is now Pinnacles National Park? Neil, why don't we start off with you? What's the significance of something like Pinnacles becoming a national park?
It's absolutely significant for the local communities and people who have been there. They recognize that Pinnacles is a special place. It's the reason why Teddy Roosevelt in 1908 designated it as a national monument. And what this does is this elevates its presence. It means that when people are, you know, either driving along the California coast and they see something on the map that says Pinnacles National Monument, is that a plaque? What is that? Is that a statue? Instead, they realized that there are 20-plus thousand acres that are open for exploration, caves to check out, wild, beautiful wildflower displays. And on full moon nights, you can get out and go for beautiful hikes as well. You have jagged rock spires. It's a place that's definitely worthy of a national park designation, which is, you know, in the minds of Americans, the highest caliber of public lands that we have.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous park, especially if you're into hiking and wildflowers. It's beautiful. We just found a story, A Brief History of Pinnacles, from KCET, and Schuyler Hain, who was a huge promoter of Pinnacles in the 1920s, said, quote, "Here the cliffs of many colored rock rise hundreds of feet in sharply defined terraces or great domes or pinnacles. Beyond and scattered over an area of some 6 square miles is a mass of conglomerate rocks, wonderful in extent and in fantastic variety of form and coloring." And before the show, Brent, you said that you've been there in the summer, which it's really hot in the summer. It's best to go in the spring because that's when the flowers are in bloom. But what would you add to that? What is the significance of Pinnacles becoming a national park?
Well, I agree with what Neil suggested is by giving it the national park designation, which is a much more familiar designation for most folks who are interested in nature and travel, it really gives it this additional prominence so that it will increase the opportunities for people to actually visit and see this wonderful, magical place. Now, you know, technically speaking, there isn't a whole lot different that the Park Service needs to do to manage the area. they've always considered, well, for many decades at least, always considered different designations from national recreation areas to national monuments to national parks to all be managed under this unique mandate of the National Park Service, what they call their preservation mandate, which requires them to ensure that the values, the resources of these areas are not impaired while we're using them to the point that future generations won't be able to see or access them. So in that sense, it should remain the same, while at the same time providing much greater visibility for the fantastic landscape that's out there.
And what was the reasoning behind this? Why did President Obama decide to turn the monument into a park?
Well, it was recognized for many years by the local congressman there, Congressman Sam Farr, who's been to the area, and he sees that this place is just, it was designated as a national monument back in 1908 because it was a presidential proclamation. It was a specific act by the president, but Congress has the ability to make the name a national park. So it's more of a recognition of what we already know. And I think the beauty of this is one of the goals here is to get more people to the place. It's their park. We all own it. You know, that's the beauty of our national parks. Every American is an equal owner in this place.
Yeah. What's the process behind the scenes? Is there a conversation about this? Is there a debate about how to decide which monument turns into a national park?
This went through a legislative process, and we can talk later on about the state of legislation and national parks in our past Congress and the Congress we just went through. But this was one piece of legislation that was bipartisan. It got through the morass. It made it to the president's desk. And at the last minute, it was signed by President Obama.
And what is the difference between a monument and a park? Is it really just the status involved?
Yeah, different national parks have different, sometimes they allow for different types of uses. For example, a national preserve would allow for hunting, for example, of certain animals. But for this case, there really won't be a difference in the types of management or what the visitor may see when they go there.
So it'll be the same experience.
It should be the same experience.
It should be the same experience. And getting back to the congressional nature of it,
right.
over several decades, there's been this back and forth between the folks who've been in charge of various units of the National Park Service on the ground, some of the administrative folks, and their interpretation of the fundamental Organic Act of the National Park Service, and then what Congress actually desired. And for a long period of time, Congress was really the agent that was pushing for greater and greater conservation across the wide spectrum of land holdings that the National Park Service managed. And so over the years, as it became apparent that occasionally the Park Service would manage different units under different kinds of management regimes, they kept essentially scolding the agency and saying, you have to preserve all of the lands that we're designating as under the national park system, regardless of whether you call it seashore, et cetera. So there's been a little bit of back and forth where historically Congress has been driving the conservation, but that's been changing. That's been changing significantly, particularly in this last Congress, which has been a great disappointment for conservationists across the country.
Well, elaborate a bit on that. What did we, or in this case, didn't we see in the last Congress? Neil? What happened last time?
Well, for one, this was the first Congress in many decades that did not actually add any lands to the national park system. This was the first Congress since 1966 that did not designate any new wilderness in this country. I mean, these are absolutely American ideas. And these things are one of the few things that we can say that we will pass on to the next generation. We may not be able to pass our cars, our houses, some of our material things, but one thing that we do own, all of us, are our national parks. And the goal is to preserve them, to expand them when we can.
What is the average Congress look like in terms of setting aside or designating wild spaces? I mean, it happens regularly, and can you talk about the history and why we didn't see anything happen last time around?
I can speak to at least what happened last year. I mean, or in the last couple of years, there simply was not enough momentum in Congress. I mean, it was trying to slice a 300-pound marshmallow. We weren't getting far in any of our efforts. And that led to President Obama seeing this, seeing the conservation movement stalling in Congress, and saying, you know, I'm going to take action. So what he did, he designated a new national park at Fort Monroe on the East Coast. He designated the Cesar Chavez National Monument here in California. He is starting to take action. And I think moving into this next Congress, you know, we hope that there will actually be efforts to from Congress to take action.
Brent, where did you experience pushback? I mean, can you tell us what happened? Did politicians try to bring this up and they got shut down, or what happened?
There are still a cadre of politicians in Congress that are supportive and active in trying to promote conservation and the creation of wildness and wilderness and national parks. But I think that the sort of the drive to prioritize these issues over the plethora of other issues facing the Congress, particularly with the more conservative elements of the Republican Party really taking charge of that political spectrum, which traditionally, you know, you could get decent support from Republicans for national parks. That's starting to dry up. And so with the competition of all these other issues, it just, you know, it isn't being prioritized the way it has been in the past. And, you know, here in the Bay Area, that's particularly disappointing, because with Philip Burton and the creation of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, you have great examples of people who not only prioritize causes that we all feel deeply about, but were exceptionally effective legislatures that could cut through that morass and make things happen. And that's really what needs to change in Congress this upcoming session.
Because the fact of the matter is, you need politicians on your side in order to preserve this space. I mean, it's interesting to look at the history. When you look at Pinnacles, it was set aside as a monument by President Theodore Roosevelt back in 1908. And I understand he was a major advocate for open space and conservation.
Right. I mean, when it comes to national parks, generally speaking, it's a bipartisan matter. I mean, it's actually nonpartisan. It's something that most Congresses, you know, they get behind. I think what Brent's saying is absolutely right. With the types of challenges that are facing our country these days, and the types of debates that are going on, it's been difficult for Congress to prioritize national parks, even in the context of funding. Mm-hmm. Right. You were saying, right, national parks, their budget represents 1/14 of 1%. Yet there are proposals to cut the national park budget. I mean, we're not going to solve our problems, our budgetary issues, by cutting national parks, by cutting other public land management agencies, places that we all enjoy, places that we need to go to when we need our mind cleared, when we're unemployed. I mean, for these different reasons.
Well, and we've seen over the years major cuts to state parks. Many state parks have closed. There have been so many campaigns to keep them open. So what are national parks facing? Because there have been, 2 years of declining funding, and now they face the prospect of additional cuts of up to 10%? Is that right, Brent? Or Neil, do you want to take that?
Yeah, national parks right now, they face a $10 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar maintenance backlog. That means that buildings or historic structures that should be open to the public, that may tell the story of a particular area or a significant event in our history, are not open. It means that roads, bridges, trails are not being maintained to the level that, you know, people expect when they go to national parks, whether it's people who are from this country or tourists that come from, you know, other countries. That's one big issue that they're facing. The other is that they're operating at a $500 million shortfall each year. And, you know, we're approaching the centennial of our national parks in 2016, only a few years away. And this is the opportunity to fix some of these problems.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, as bad as the national park picture is funding-wise, as you noted, Rose, I mean, the state parks are facing an even greater crisis. In fact, here in the Bay Area, with this backlog of maintenance funding that the national park faces, they're still stepping in to manage some of the state parks that the state's just abandoning on us. And so it's still, in the grand scheme of things, in the kinds of public spaces that governments are helping provide, helping us all own and provide access to, it's still doing a little better than some of the other agencies that are in charge of these resources. But when you start looking at the backlog of maintenance and the constant shortfalls and really the politically expedient choices that Congress continues to make to pull funding from those that are least fortunate or those that don't have a voice for themselves. Like, you know, Neil and I are just proxies for the park. The park doesn't get to show up itself and demand for something, right? So you see that happening over and over again. And it really is going to require a larger mass movement to demand change to fix that kind of a problem.
That is Brent Plater. He's executive director of the Wild Equity Institute, a nonprofit uniting the grassroots conservation and environmental justice movements. He's also a lecturer in San Francisco State's Environmental Studies Department. We are also joined by Neil Desai, Pacific Region Associate Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Their mission is to protect and enhance national parks for present and future generations. And today we are talking about national parks. On January 10th, Pinnacles National Monument became Pinnacles National Park. Pinnacles is just east of Monterey. It's a 26,000 area expanse where biologists release condors as part of a captive breeding program to bring them back from extinction. The hiking there is amazing, especially if you love boulders, caves, and wildflowers. It's a dream if you're a hiker. They also have a great campground. So what are your thoughts on this? If you're a fan of Pinnacles, what are your thoughts on it? Switching from a national monument to a national park. What do you enjoy about national parks? What do they mean to you? And knowing that national parks only receive 1/14 of 1% of the overall federal budget, as in we just heard, they've got a $10 billion maintenance backlog and a $500 million shortfall. What would you say to politicians about the importance of supporting the park system? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. I think one of the reasons why this doesn't get much attention is because there's so much attention on the debt, the so-called fiscal cliff, and these kinds of things. And the fighting in Washington. So you don't really hear that much about the importance of preserving this open space. So what can we do to give this more attention? And what would you like to add to this conversation? We have two interesting emails about Pinnacles. Carl writes in and says, one of my favorite aspects of Pinnacles is that it lies on a fault. And if one is aware of that and looks carefully, it's fascinating and kind of eerie to notice the vestiges of vastly different habitats on different sides of the trails. Glad it's now recognized as a national park. It's also really great to actually go in the cave and think about that. And then we have an email from Joe who says, I'm wondering if there's any downside to changing the designation of Pinnacles and whether the local congressman's impetus for pushing the change wasn't mostly economic, a desire for more tourists, therefore more money in the area. More people will not necessarily be better for the wildlife or ecosystem, right? Just think of Yosemite National Park as theme park or zoo, for example. The San Jose Mercury News had a good article about this, and they did quote a number of people working for various chambers in the area, and they said that they're very happy, and they hope that this does drive more tourists, which will then result in people spending more money. So what are your thoughts on that, Neil?
Well, What we know of the area and the surrounding region of tourists who are in the area is that people don't know about Pinnacles,
right.
And so it is something. It is a national treasure worth going to and seeing. Now, here's the thing. I mean, generally speaking, across this country, we have a deficit here of people getting outside, experiencing nature, and that's really the first step. People need to have these personal experiences, whether it's with the family, with a loved one, by yourself, to be able to get out, see and experience these places, learn, maybe see a condor out there, maybe see some beautiful wildflowers, inquire, wonder about the science behind it, the geology, and hopefully that then speaks to the movement that Brent is talking about, where people then realize, wow, this place is special. Not only do I want to see it right now in my generation, but I want to make sure that future generations can see this as well.
And I definitely also am concerned about the possibility that, you know, we could have the kinds of overload of people that you have on sometimes summer days in Yosemite Valley or something like that. You know, that's definitely a management issue that needs to be considered. But the probability of that happening in Pinnacles is pretty low. It seems unlikely to happen there for a wide variety of reasons. But I would also say, you know, one of the other things that really is at risk in our society today is just having the opportunity to be contemplative and away from the distractions of our emails and our phones, there's all these this talk about nature deficit disorder in kids, but also in adults these days. And by if we can do something to highlight the opportunities near urban areas, you know, within a couple hours drive, for people to get out and experience the wild a little bit, I think that will overall create a better relationship that people maintain with the landscapes overall, so that when they do visit these areas or make decisions about them when they're back home in the voting booth or something else, that they have a more sustainable relationship to these landscapes, even if visitation increases a little bit.
And what about, I mean, there are other examples of this, right? Because there's another recent story about Drake's Estero. And many environmentalists call this a victory for wilderness in Point Reyes. A lot of people, like farmers, argue that this is a loss for them. And it's interesting, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein, supported Pinnacles becoming a national park, but for Drake's, she opposed it. She was siding with some of the oyster companies. Can you give us a little bit of background on this one?
Sure. And Drake's Estero was a monumental historic achievement for all America. I mean, this was the first marine wilderness designated in the lower 48 in the continental U.S. And basically it entails a promise to taxpayers and people who bought this property back in 1972. The government bought a parcel of land where an oyster company was operating. The deal was pay them money right now, let them stay for 40 years. The public, on the other hand, would have to wait until the 40 years ended for public access, for protection to occur. Congress subsequently designated the area as a wilderness area. And wilderness is something that we can create. It's not it is something that we can set aside, and we determine that we are going to let nature's heartbeat be the guide for this area. It's not going to be our taste buds, our business plans, the hands of man at work. And this is special because, you know, Tamales Bay has boats and oyster companies and a lot of human use. You know, San Francisco Bay has ships and development all over. It's completely impaired. It's been dredged. This is our one place on the West Coast where we can set aside a place for wildlife to thrive, for humans to experience an estuary in its natural environment. And that takes compromises and deals. And back then, the deal was made that this use would end when this contract ended. And that's what happened. And Secretary Salazar made a fantastic decision for all Americans in designating this area.
What would you add, Brent?
Well, you know, I think the reason Drake's Estero became so important to me and so many people in the environmental movement, in addition to the traditional reasons that we clamor for wilderness, is that especially here in the Bay Area, so much of the wildness that was once here is gone. Mm. I mean, if you look at a map of San Francisco and just see how many of the sand dunes are now these great avenues in the Sunset and the Richmond, and all of this loss, all of this impairment of land, I argue, creates a debt that we owe to the wild. And places like Point Reyes and the wilderness designation there, maybe it's not the most pristine wildness that we'll ever experience, but it's part of our opportunity to make a kind of reparations, an opportunity for us to say, look, we recognize that in some places we've overstepped our bounds, and we're going to try to be a little more humble, have a little more humility and our relationship to that landscape. And really, that's what that wilderness designation means to me and to a lot of folks, and why it was such an important victory.
Oh, it's such an interesting visual. How do we become more humble, especially when we're talking about preserving open space and land? Today we're talking about preserving national parks. Pinnacles National Monument recently became Pinnacles National Park. What do national parks mean to you? And if you've got a story you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back after this.
Call here on KALW, San Francisco. We invite you to join in today's conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, send an email, comment, or question to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a message there, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of the former CIA analyst John Kiriakou, who was sentenced just recently to 30 months in prison for exposing information on the CIA's torture program. We'll also talk about John Kerry, who was confirmed as Secretary of State on Tuesday, and we'll talk about the ongoing deadly clashes in Egypt. And then coming up on Monday, we'll talk about the importance of mental health programs. There's so much attention on gun control, but what about mental health? We'll talk about that on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the importance of our national parks system. Pinnacles National Monument recently became Pinnacles National Park. It is now the country's 59th national park. Pinnacles was first set aside as a monument in 1908. By President Theodore Roosevelt. And back then, politicians actually did use the word humble. Let's be humble about our open space and our natural land. You don't really hear that word that much these days, unfortunately. So what will it take to really preserve this space and to send a message to Washington that that these parks should be funded? Because right now they are dealing with a $10 billion maintenance backlog, $500 million shortfall. And then when you look at funding, it's 1/14 of 1% of the federal budget. So is this an issue that you work on, that you care about? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. And if you visit national parks, which one have you visited recently and what's your experience been like? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's next go to Steve in Oakland. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rose. Slightly contrarian view. As a longtime user of national parks all over, camping out in them and things, I'm actually concerned that raising the status of Pinnacles to national park will increase people's expectations, pushing for every part of the park to be accessible to everybody. When Clinton created the Grand Staircase Escalante Monument, which I think will be his biggest legacy, I was one of the people in the scoping project. How do we deal with it? And what I said at the time was, don't make it accessible to people like me. I'm in my 60s. I had a shot to walk around. I shouldn't be able to get to every corner of it. Don't develop it to do that. Leave it alone. And I think as we raise the level, we then tend to destroy the possibility of leaving it as wilderness, semi-wilderness, or whatever. I think the parks are under threat in a sense as much from a leftist as a rightist perspective. You can have too much of a good thing. If people's expectations are, oh, now it's a park, now I should be able to see every bit of it, well, you will have roads, the budgets will increase, there will be more pushback from the right. And I think you've got a problem there. You have to look at it from both ends of the spectrum. It's not just the oil drillers that can destroy a park.
It's an interesting comment, because what are your thoughts on this? Now that it is a national park, I love going to Pinnacles. And they've got a little store that sells, you know, a canned soups and things. They don't really have much. And so I can imagine that people would say, well, it's a national park. Shouldn't you have a nice concession stand where I can have lunch with my family? What are your thoughts about that and the issues that Steve raises, Neil?
And thanks for that comment, Steve. I mean, it's a very valid comment. And I think what's going to happen is that the park maybe do some additional planning. They'll do some monitoring. Right now, you have around 370,000 people who come to Pinnacles each year. The important thing is, you know, we want to make sure we don't have, you know, a sort of Yosemite Valley situation
there.
And there are physical constraints and reasons why certain experiences become negative because of overdevelopment in particular places in national parks. Like Brent was saying, I don't think that's going to be the case here, but I do think there will be more visitors. And it's important, you know, for the National Park Service to make sure that they're monitoring it, making sure that the quality of experience for the visitor is still very high.
Yeah, I want to echo the caller's concerns as well, because I agree. There is a problem when people perceive national parks to be the same thing as their local city park, which might have pavement all over it, basketball courts, whatever, playgrounds. You know, the National Park Service tries to deal with this tension. I mean, it has this tension inherent in its mandate. On the one hand, it's designed to preserve these valuable resources unimpaired for future generations, while at the same time providing opportunities for people to recreate in them presently. And that inherently has some tension. So what the Park Service tries to do, and I think has a really great opportunity to do down in Pinnacles, is to do it right. Has the opportunity to do it right because what this designation will do for this area is increase the visibility, while at the same time having the opportunity to reshape this mentality that people sometimes carry to the parks and say, hey, look, we're doing something unique here that will help you experience this landscape in a more humble way than you might be used to in these city parks.
And when parks become, or when places become national parks, as Steve said, do they open more space to the public? Because his argument is that humans have too much access to the lands.
Not necessarily, no.
Okay, but it is a possibility.
Hey, it can be. I mean, but that's not a reflection of it being a national park. That's just a reflection of any sort of planning that may occur. Maybe they realize they need more campgrounds.
Right. Because the campgrounds and Pinnacles are pretty small. I mean, sure. If you don't put your name in, actually, probably this month, you won't be able to camp there in the spring.
Sure.
Yeah, and that campground has an interesting history. I mean, it was a private campground for years that was just operating on the actual fringe of the park. And then when the owners of that campground wanted to retire or sell it for whatever reason, the Park Service just bought it, in fact, to prevent more intense urbanization of that little area. And so they've kind of, you know, been trying to keep it in that kind of a scale. You know, it's not the designation itself that would command you know, more roads, more trails, more intensified human experiences in the park. What sometimes does push it is if the scale of the people attempting to use the park becomes so great, then they have to rethink how they provide access to user groups. And even more important than that, than the scale of it, is sort of how people react to the landscape. When people come into that park and act carelessly, mm-hmm. Sometimes having less invasive recreational opportunities leads to greater degradation because people don't know that they need to stay on the trail. And so you got to put a fence there to keep them from screwing up the entire place. And that starts to degrade the user experience a little bit. So, you know, I agree that this is going to be this creates some challenges for the Park Service. But I think especially at Pinnacles with its geographic location and the history of the place, that's going to be one spot we have a real great opportunity to do it right.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Steve. Let's hear next from Mark in Hollister, and he's with the group Friends of Pinnacles. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Actually, I'm the executive director of a nonprofit friends group for Pinnacles National Monument that's rather young, 6 years old, called Pinnacles Partnership. And I just wanted to thank you and your guests for bringing some attention to America's newest national park. And also draw some attention to a document that can be found on the park's website, the draft general management plan, which is kind of like a general plan. It's a guiding document for probably the next two decades of the park. It was recently completed, and unfortunately the public comment period has just closed. But I think it's a remarkable document, and it really speaks to a lot of the conversation that's been taking place. The preferred alternative outlined in the draft plan is, for lack of a more artful term, called the hybrid plan. And it really sought to strike exactly the balance that you're talking about between resource protection and an enhanced visitor experience. So a lot of the things you've been addressing about camping and that sort of thing are in the draft plan. And also, while the east side of the park, that is the site access via Hollister or King City, gets most of the visitation, there's a western entrance near Soledad that just got a new visitor center that opened about a year ago that's absolutely spectacular. It was built with the federal stimulus funds. It's a LEED Platinum visitor center. It's completely off the grid. And both sides of the park are kind of unusual. They're both accessed via State Highway 146, but the highway doesn't connect in the middle, and it won't, because most of Pinnacles is a designated wilderness area.
Right. And Mark, let me ask you just quickly, do you expect many changes in the years to come?
Well, initially, no. You know, as has been pointed out, the difference between a national monument and a national park is almost semantic. You know, one is created by presidential decree. Theodore Roosevelt created Pinnacles National Monument, as has been said, in 1908. It's kind of interesting that that makes Pinnacles National Monument actually 8 or 6 years older than the National Park Service. And it takes an act of Congress to create a national park. That doesn't mean an increase initially in staffing or funding, but it does bring with it an important recognition. Most national monuments exist because there's one resource that's sort of the marquee resource that the monument's intended to recognize and showcase.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, Mark. And why don't we go through a few more callers, and then we'll get responses from Neil and Brent. Let's hear from Katie in Monterey. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for your show. I am currently living in Monterey working with a whale watch company. But last year, I was a volunteer intern with Ventana Wildlife Society, which partners with Pinnacles monitoring the California condor flock in the Central Coast. And I just really, I know everyone with the Condor Project is excited that Pinnacles has been made a national park, because that really raises awareness about, you know, getting more visitors to the park and, you know, raising awareness about the condors and their plight as endangered species. And so I just hope that by it becoming a park, you know, there'll be more visitors approaching the park and getting, you know, maybe seeing a condor. And when you see one of those birds with their amazing 9.5-foot wingspan, it's great.
Yeah, it is incredible. What is the status of the Condor Protection Project?
Well, they're critically endangered, and they're facing a lot of struggles from, their main problem is with lead poisoning from eating their carrion eaters, so they eat carcasses, so they might find a deer or a wild boar or some other, you know, roadkill or, you know, a meat food source that's been contaminated with lead bullets, and they can get really seriously poisoned and
right.
have to bring them to a zoo to get rehabilitated.
So these are animals that have been shot with...
They're not the condors, they're like a deer or...
Right.
You know,
right, the animals that have been shot, and then the bullets have lead in them, and then the condor eats the animal.
Or like a dot pile that a hunter leaves behind. And like, we don't support hunting, and we support copper ammunition instead, because that doesn't leave behind poison for the birds.
Right.
Yeah, there's both acute and chronic lead poisoning of condors now and then. So every once in a while, you hear about someone who shoots a condor, claims that it was, they thought it was a turkey vulture, which they shouldn't be shooting anyways. And maybe once in a while, Fish and Wildlife Service will prosecute those instances, but not often. But the bigger problem is this chronic exposure to lead. And while there are some natural sources of lead, the most likely source of lead are the gut piles that are left behind after hunters skin the animals. And these lead bullets, they fragment very easily. They hit bone. You have small pieces of lead going off both into the meat that the hunter carries home, and then they're consuming themselves, and in the gut piles they leave behind. And, you know, there are all sorts of alternatives to lead bullets that can be used or required to be used that shoot sometimes even straighter than the lead bullets. Often they're a little more expensive, but, you know, if you're firing off more than a couple of rounds when you're hunting, you have bigger problems than how much money you're spending on bullets.
Jeez. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for calling in, Katie. And today we are talking about the value of national parks, and so many different issues obviously come up when we're talking about national parks. I first learned about this issue at the park, because they have a lot of brochures in the visitor center about what is happening to these animals. Today we're joined by Neil Desai, Pacific Region Associate Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Brent Plater is Executive Director of the Wild Equity Institute. And today we're talking about the value of national parks. Just a couple of weeks ago, Pinnacles National Monument, which is east of Monterey, became the country's 59th national park. So what are your thoughts on this? And we're just talking about trying to create a balance between humans accessing this space and really keeping it wild. What are your thoughts on that? And if you have a story about a national park, what can we do to really raise awareness about preserving these parks and then funding them? We're talking about a $10 billion maintenance backlog, $500 million shortfall, and for our 59 national parks, they receive 1/14 of 1% of the federal budget. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And we have just about 10 minutes left. And let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. I'm wondering how the process goes when they plan a national park as to what improvements will be made, and you know, on a city level for a city park, there might be some outreach to the community about what they want. I get this sense that the feds don't do that, and it feels more detached from the people who will use that. So, as an example, Land's End in San Francisco is a national park and was remade, and what they did was they put in a parking lot that, while it looks nice, is 3 times larger than the old one and actually holds fewer cars, and then they paved a lot of the trails that were formerly dirt. And to me, what a hike in the park means is actually walking on the earth, not pavement. So, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, as a global question, what input the public can have. It doesn't seem like there's much other than saying we want a national park, but then how do they do it? The devil or the goddess is in the details.
Yeah, good question. Thank you. Neil, do you want to take that first?
Sure, and thank you for that. Thank you for that comment. It is in a way very similar to the planning that would occur at the city level. In theory, you know, there should be outreach to the community. There should be education on what are the values, the resources, the type of experiences that we're trying to protect. Get that feedback from the community. Weave that into a plan. You know, a draft phase. Get your comments on it. You put the final plan together. And in the end, you hope that in this whole mumble jumble of stuff, that something good comes out. And that happens. Many of the times, it doesn't happen all of the times. Sometimes, we have to respond. I mean, NPCA, our organization, we're the Park Service's best friend, but we're also their harshest critic. You know, we have to sue them sometimes because we don't agree with their ability to follow the law and policy. It could be because of political pressure that occurs.
What were some of your recent lawsuits?
Well, we've been engaged in a multi-year lawsuit at Yellowstone for the ability to protect wildlife and the human visitor experience from the amount of snowmobiles that are being brought into the park for commercial hunting operations that were occurring down in the Channel Islands. I mean, political pressure is always going to be put forward on national parks. And the interesting thing is national parks don't belong to the community that's immediately next door to them. They belong to all Americans. And so when decisions are made, they should be made in the best interest of all Americans. And sometimes that doesn't happen.
And just speaking specifically about Land's End, you know, I've visited the area as well, both before and after the restoration occurred. And it is a beautiful restoration, a real great success story. I would have preferred a smaller parking lot personally as well. But as Neil suggests, the parks are owned by all of us, and that includes people with disabilities. And another law that overlaps on this management mandate is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And part of the paving of trails there, and to some degree the parking lot, is designed to help provide accommodations for people who aren't as able-bodied as perhaps you and me or something like that. So there, you know, there are reasons behind it. It isn't just sort of fiat or in favor of concrete in each case. I hear what you're saying. I could see why, you know, some other decisions could be preferable under other kinds of criteria.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ken. We've spoken a number of times about what's been happening in Yosemite Valley. And for people who don't get there that much, can you talk about the changes you've seen in Yosemite Valley over the years? And what do you think of them, Neil?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that Yosemite Valley is such a small sliver of the actual park. I mean, it would be amazing if more people got into the actual backcountry and the wilderness area, but unfortunately, partly because of the way it's designed, where it goes in, it does a little loop, and it dead ends, there's a high concentration of people, and over the years, just inappropriate development, to the point where you wonder if you're getting a high quality experience that you should be. When people come there, will they start in their minds, right, start to think this is what we expect in all types of national parks? Right now, there is a planning process. The gentleman who just called in before asked about a planning process. Well, there is one going on right now for the Merced River plan, which is the river that flows through that valley. And the plan is to look at, what type of access should we provide to the river, types of recreation that should occur around it, and the types of development. So this is a real opportunity for people. And from our polling, people in San Francisco and the Bay Area love Yosemite.
Right. I mean,
it's their national park, even though Golden Gate's closer. a lot of people love Yosemite, so I would encourage listeners to visit the Yosemite website and plug in and, share your voice. It is your voice. You own this park.
Yeah, I would say even when it's jammed with too many people, experiencing Yosemite Valley and seeing the landscape down there is one of the great senses of wonder that you can have, that you can experience. I think the changes have been very contentious. I think sometimes the Park Service feels overwhelmed by the crush of humanity that wants access to that place, and they have this temptation just to give in so that they can continue to focus on management of the rest of the landscape at Yosemite, which is vast and almost always empty. And, so there's been some great contentions there, and I think slowly improvements are being made. I think the new director of that national park is gonna help improve that outcomes on the floor of Yosemite Valley. But again, as difficult as it may be sometimes to travel through there, it's still one of the great wonders of the world.
And we have just a couple of minutes left. What are you working on right now? I mean, where do you see this going in the future, considering what we dealt with in the last Congress, which was really nothing changed, nothing moved? Mm-hmm. Neil?
We're seeing, I think one of the most important critical issues that's happening right now is the debate on funding, the fiscal cliff, the debt. And when our elected officials are going to be making decisions, we want to make sure that they're not short-sighted to the point where we're talking about, slashing our national park budget. And, we have the upcoming, right, summer season, lots of visitation, people planning visits. I think it would be important for, as many people as possible to plug in and let your elected official know that this is important.
Can you name some California champions of the national parks and maybe name those who need to be pushed a little bit?
Well, Barbara Boxer has always been a great vote for national parks and the environment. Strangely enough, Dianne Feinstein has been a champion for creating parks in the desert southeast of California, even though she hasn't been nearly as strong or as supportive of conservation or wilderness in the rest of the states in some cases, particularly out there at Drake's Bay. It's been a big problem. So they've been great. And, of course, George Miller is one of the great conservationists probably in modern history anyways of Congress on both parks and open spaces and wildness and endangered species. And he's just over there sort of in the East Bay area. So those have been some good champs.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean, getting people to change votes of folks who will never change. A lot of times it's, letting people know who are even champions to say, hey, when you're on the floor of Congress, make this a point, right? Raise the national park issue. Once it gets into the public debate, then that leads to visibility. It starts getting into the papers, the media. It then leads to change. I mean, that's one big issue that's going on. Another big issue that we're going, Brett mentioned the California desert. We're going through a major planning process that will really reshape the look and the feel of the California desert, and that is the solar energy development,
right,
that's occurring. And
we did a show about that, but it's been a while.
Yeah, and it's moving forward, and there are major decisions going on right now that will affect the ability of endangered wildlife. We're talking about the desert tortoise to survive, the ability to protect contiguous areas of open space from wildlife migration, and there are proper places to house these solar development projects, especially on like disturbed lands. We don't have to make destroy our pristine landscapes.
And in addition, a lot of what Neil and I have to do is stop bad things from happening. But here in the Bay Area, we also have opportunities to make beautiful things. There's an opportunity to create a new national park on a piece of city-owned land in Pacifica called Sharp Park. And there's a plan to make that a part of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. You can find out more about that campaign and plug in at our website, wildequity.org. And the beautiful thing about that is not only will we have a new national park that will provide recreational opportunities that everybody can enjoy, but San Francisco will save money in the process because they're losing money on that, subsidizing a suburban golf course down there at the moment. So they bring that money back home and invest it in our local neighborhood parks if we succeed.
And what's the status of that right now?
Right now, we're looking to get the champions that we've had at the Board of Supervisors to bring the issue back again. We got an ordinance passed that would make that happen last year, and then Mayor Ed Lee, big-time golfer, vetoed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we're going to go have a talk with him sometime soon.
That is Sharp Park, and it's owned by San Francisco, but located in Pacifica, and we'll find more information on the website. Yeah, I'm glad you guys brought up the desert, because we need to revisit that and do a show about that. So thank you so much. Neil Desai, Pacific Region Associate Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. Brent Plater is Executive Director of the Wild Equity Institute. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Find more information about our national parks at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar at Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the former CIA analyst John Kiriakou, who was sentenced to 30 months in prison for exposing information on the CIA's torture program. We'll also talk about John Kerry, who is confirmed as Secretary of State, and the ongoing deadly clashes in Egypt. We'll be joined by Harper Scott Horton, Fire Dog Lake's Kevin Gostola, and Al Jazeera's Shireen Tadros. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.